I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Congress is back in session after its August recess, and already there's talk about a government shutdown because of a fight over spending, including the funding of Planned Parenthood. Also at issue is money for the Highway Trust Fund that expires at the end of October and whether to increase the debt ceiling at the end of November. And while it looks like President Obama has enough support for the Iran agreement, Congress is not done with a deal. We have two guests who have joined us in this hour of Radio Times. Kelsey Snell is congressional reporter for The Washington Post, joining us from the Hill. And Kelsey Snell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is David Lightman. He's national political correspondent, a veteran congressional reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. And David Lightman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
David, let me start with you. Is Congress on track for another government shutdown?
50-50. I know that's not much of an answer, but it's probably accurate. You get presidential politics all twisted into this because you've got at least two Republican senators who probably see this as a way to get up there, get attention, break out of the crowd, which they haven't been able to do. The problem is that it taints the Republican Party if, in fact, they shut down over this issue. It tainted them a couple of years ago, and I think the Republican leaders are really concerned that it just hurts the brand.
To you, Kelsey, as you watch what's happening in Congress this week, is there a sense, as David said, 50-50, do you want to give it more or less than that of a chance?
You know, if you had asked me earlier this week, I would have said that that I didn't think that we were actually going to be headed for a shutdown. But the way things have played out over the past couple of days makes me believe that there's a strong current of this anti-establishment sense coming from Republicans in the House. And that is always a troubling situation when you're talking about shutdown, because as they gather more steam, they can start detracting more and more votes from what is needed to get something passed.
And is it about funding Planned Parenthood? Is that this issue that seems to be, if not dividing Congress, could lead to a shutdown, Kelsey?
Yeah, that is what started out as the main issue for a large group of Republicans. The conservatives on the far right were saying that they didn't want to vote for any kind of spending bill that includes money for Planned Parenthood. And continuing the current funding, which is the provision under consideration right now, still includes the funds for Planned Parenthood that have traditionally been there. They, as of yesterday, had about 28 members saying they would not vote for any spending bill, but those numbers seem to be rising.
Well, and go ahead.
Let me follow on that point, because you make a very good point. How far does this rebellion among House Republicans go? I mean, it was ugly yesterday, as Kelsey saw, and does that carry over into other things? And that's the wild card right now. I mean, how strong is the speaker? How strong is his leadership team? If this thing erupts into all-out rebellion, then, shutdown could happen and a number of other things.
Well, David, how strong is the speaker, John Boehner?
You know, I sort of sigh when I hear that, because we've been saying that and writing that now for years. And as you know, every time he's been up for re-election, there's been these sort of mini rebellions. They could never quite get their act together. At the moment, it still seems to be in that league, but it's growing. And I think as the election draws near and people start assessing the party's chances and what the party may stand for, I think he gets a little shakier. I still think he's okay, but I'm sort of less certain of that than I might have been, say, a month ago.
How about for you, Kelsey?
You know, I'm completely on the same side, David. I think that as we sit here counting votes, and whether or not Republicans will have enough votes necessary to get a continuing resolution for spending through, I think we're counting similar votes in terms of who might be willing to step up and say they have no confidence in the speaker. I think that there's a dual counting going on now.
It's interesting. Mitch McConnell was quoted, and of course, he's over in the Senate, that defunding Planned Parenthood is not a workable solution or a workable idea unless there's a Republican in the White House. And of course, President Obama said that he would veto it if it didn't include money for Planned Parenthood. Kelsey, where does this put Mitch McConnell?
Well, Mitch McConnell has been pretty clear. He does not want to shut down, and he doesn't want to deal with Planned Parenthood in this way. And I think he seems to be a little bit more firm about this, and he seems to be controlling the message a little bit better than Boehner is at this point.
What's interesting, David, is you've got the House versus the Senate, not Republicans versus Democrats.
Not unusual, because to make things work in the House, you've got to be a little more conciliatory. You need 60 votes to make things work. And you look at the history of Republican or Democratic majority leaders, and they usually have to have some kind of bipartisan support. They can't go too far out, whereas the rules of the House are different, and obviously you only need a simple majority to cut off debate. So Mitch McConnell is very much a man of the institution, and he's also a man who has gotten where he is because he makes things work. So all this seems logical to me, and I think the action, as Kelsey said, on this is probably going to end up in the House.
Kelsey, let me go back. And something you mentioned earlier, in 2013, I guess, was the last government shutdown. Who were the winners and losers out of that shutdown?
Well, I think that it's pretty clear that there weren't any real winners in shutting down the government. I mean, though, if we're thinking about it completely on a political level, Democrats did wind up getting a lot more leverage out of that situation. They were able to force kinder situation for them in terms of spending, and they were able to leverage more priorities. And I think that if we reach a point, which it increasingly looks like we will, that Republicans require a significant number of Democratic votes to get a spending bill through, Democrats, again, will get the upper hand.
Meaning maybe they want this government shutdown?
I don't think they want a government shutdown, but I don't think they're unhappy with the situation, any situation where they get to have leverage when they typically have been put on the back burner and had to play from the sidelines.
I mean, David, leverage as the minority party.
Well, here's what I think the dilemma is for Democrats and Republicans. We all wrote, and the polls all showed, that Republicans were the losers in 2013. And yet in 2014, who won control of Congress, right?
Right.
The problem is, out there in the hinterlands, out there in Philadelphia, what voters are saying is we're disgusted with everybody in Washington, Democrats and Republicans. So if the government shuts down, I suspect voters aren't going to sit there picking through it to see which party did what to whom. They're going to say, why can't you people get things together? They're going to blame everybody. And I think it's going to reverberate to all incumbents.
Do members of Congress care about that, David?
Oh, yeah, very much so, on two levels. First of all, self-preservation, particularly in closer races, but also the party itself. I mean, how in the world can an incumbent senator or governor who may end up running for president sell him or herself when, in fact, people say we want Washington to work and they're part of Washington? That's a real potential problem.
Kelsey, let me go back to you, and I want to make sure our listeners understand. If we're talking about, a continuing resolution or stopgap spending, translate that into language that the rest of us will understand. What does that mean?
Yeah, so the federal government runs out of the fiscal year at the end of this month. The Congress needs to authorize spending going forward. It has become increasingly clear that they are just not going to be able to do the regular order, which would fund the government for another fiscal year. So as a result, they're going to have to pass a short-term spending bill. We call it a continuing resolution because it continues funding at the previous level. So it's basically making sure that the trains continue running on time exactly as they were running the month before. What they will need to do after that is they will have to come up with a longer-term patch. Right now, it looks like they're talking about something on the order of 2 to 3 months of spending authority, maybe less. And then in that time, Democrats will meet with Republicans, and they'll work out some sort of deal for the year going forward.
David, is that any way to fund the government by doing it every couple of months?
You know, that's the issue. And now, to date myself, way back when I first came to Congress in 1981, right, Ronald Reagan's first year, they couldn't figure this out. And they went into Thanksgiving, and they actually shut the government for a couple of hours. I remember on Monday morning. And people said, oh, my God, the government can't function on continuing resolutions. There's no long-term planning here. Nobody can make long-term plans. There's no policy. Well, here we are 35 years later, and the government's still humming. We can argue that it may not be as humming as efficiently as possible, but the one puzzle I've had all these years is, what does this matter? And I can't give you a good answer.
So you're saying that it works in spite of itself?
Yeah. I mean, look, it would be better if they went through regular order, if 12 spending bills were enacted after all these detailed hearings, and policy was set, and long-term planning was there. I mean, look at the mess over the highway funding right now. But it isn't. And the government continues to function, probably not as efficiently or as well as it might, but it does continue to function. So there's a great story to be done there about does this matter? And we've tried to do it over the years. And Kelsey, good luck. I just don't know.
Yeah, I like
guess
that
the ball
idea
is in your court,
in
Kelsey. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I like I like that idea of working in spite of itself. I think that that's a lot of what we've seen this past year. And frankly, since I've been here, which is considerably less amount of time than David has.
Well, we like to have several generations on one show at one time. Kelsey, let me go back to you because David mentioned the highway bill or the transit funding bill. I forget what the official title is. Where does that stand and how important is that?
You know, that the where does that stand question is something we've been trying to get answered since they passed the short-term bill earlier this year. They will, again, have to be addressing highway funding in October. October 29th is when the spending authority runs out for highways, roads, bridges, and public transit. So as soon as they are done figuring out how to keep the government open, they will have to turn their attention to making sure that highways get funded. And it's not entirely clear how they're going to do that. They all agree that highway funding and transit funding is important, but as is common here, nobody agrees on how to pay for it.
Well, is there a question about raising taxes? My understanding is that the federal tax hasn't been raised in many years.
Right. So there are a lot of people who say that raising the gas tax would be the best long-term solution, but that is not a politically feasible solution and not one that has been seriously considered as a way to pay for it. More likely, I think, is that they will use a combination of fees and changes to other programs, like selling off portions of the strategic oil reserve in order to pay for it.
How do you see that, David? About a minute before our first break here. And this is, I mean, it seems bridges, roads, these are things that people use every day, and they can tell you if they're in good repair or not.
This tells you a lot about the politics of our age, because nobody wants to raise the gas tax. They don't want to be accused of raising taxes. They used to raise gasoline taxes, and conservative Republicans went along with this because it was a user fee. In other words, it wasn't a tax necessarily. They would say, well, people use the roads and pay for the repair and upkeep. And that's how they sort of got away with it politically. But since the mid-90s, that doesn't work anymore. Hmm. And as a result, you have this mess.
Well, should we just rebrand it and then it would get somehow it would pass muster, David?
You would think that would work, yeah. But again, it doesn't anymore, because in this day and age, people like to simplify things to black and white. And, you know, the fear that among conservatives particularly, government is wasteful. If you raise taxes, they're just going to spend it. And this is yet another tax. So there.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. That's David Lightman. He's a national political correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Also with us, Kelsey Snell. She's congressional reporter for The Washington Post. It's Ballot Talks on Radio Times. And we're getting an update on Congress back in session after the August holiday. To join the conversation, call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll play a clip of Senator Cruz after this short break. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with David Lightman and Kelsey Snell about what Congress has been up to in the last couple of days, having just gotten back from the August recess. And one of the issues before Congress has to do with the Iran deal. It looks like President Obama has enough support for the deal. Nonetheless, some members of Congress are not done with it. And I do want to play a clip of Senator Ted Cruz speaking at a rally yesterday, warning that Americans will die if the Iran deal goes through. Let's listen.
It's worth remembering that if this deal goes through, we know to an absolute certainty people will die. Americans will die. Israelis will die. Europeans will die. Osama bin Laden never had $100 billion. He was filled with bilious hatred and using rudimentary tools murdered nearly 3,000 Americans on September 11th, 2001. We're now talking about giving the Ayatollah Khamenei, a theocratic homicidal maniac who hates America every bit as much as bin Laden did, giving him $100 billion to carry out his murderous plan.
David, who's the audience for Ted Cruz's talk yesterday, and he was there with Sarah Palin. Donald Trump was there as well.
Yeah, the Tea Party Patriots, conservative grassroots movement, been fairly effective, very effective in 2010, a little less so in 12 and 14. I think what's interesting here is that even though they were talking to a movement that's been identified with conservative Republicans, this whole debate cuts somewhat across party lines. It's sort of like any debate about war and national security. There's not necessarily anybody who's right or wrong. We don't know, and we won't know for maybe 30, 40 years who's on what side here. Cruz has his point of view. I just came from a breakfast with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chairman of the Democratic Party. She has her point of view. It's a tough, tough thing to talk about, and tough thing politically for everybody.
Well, Kelsey, going back to you, and it looks like, I believe, 41 senators, all Democrats and not all Democrats, do support this deal, but 41 are at least on record for supporting the deal. How does that change whatever Congress may or may not do, or I guess the Senate may or may not do?
Right. Well, so it sets it up so that the Democrats can basically filibuster the this is where things get a little complicated, yeah, as they often do in Congress. They are voting on a measure of disapproval instead of approval. So if voting against the motion of disapproval is voting for the Iran deal. So basically, there are enough Democrats to make sure that this deal goes through. And there's enough support at this point. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that he wants to continue debate and give people an opportunity to cast their votes and to share their opinions and, you know, really take part in this process. It does make it a little bit difficult in the House because that means that whatever they do end up voting on is slightly meaningless because they won't be able to override a veto from President Obama.
Has there been an actual debate as we might understand it or recognize it, Kelsey?
Well, there were more members on the floor, more senators on the floor yesterday, listening to one another speak than you often see. And I think that you'll continue to see that throughout today. And there's been some fairly vigorous debate, if not on the Senate floor, in the hallways and amongst members for the past several months.
And the deadline, it was 60 days after the agreement was, agreed to by the member countries, Kelsey. The deadline for Congress is September 17th, about a week from today.
Yes, and although we do think that they may finish their work by the end of this week. They have until next week, but the cards have already kind of been dealt on this one, and it's just a matter of choosing the timing.
David, I'm curious about how you think of this presidential race is playing out in Congress. As you said, two current senators are running for the presidency, and Donald Trump, of course, taking up a lot of the news and the headlines. How is that playing out?
Well, yeah, actually, there's four senators running for president. I had Rand Paul in there, although he hasn't been quite as vocal as Cruz. And then you have Marco Rubio, Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side.
Yes.
Who's having a press conference as we speak up at the Capitol right now, and another one later this afternoon. This is a dilemma for them because on the one hand, they want to do their jobs. They want to vote. They want to participate. On the other hand, they know they'd better be in New Hampshire, Iowa, et cetera, just hanging around town halls and walking down the streets of whatever, Gorham, New Hampshire. So what do you do? Do you try to get noticed in Washington or do you try to get noticed in New Hampshire? And that's sort of what we're seeing playing out here. There's no easy answer, and we just have to kind of watch. It'll be interesting to see what kind of publicity Sanders gets today. And it'll be interesting to see if Cruz breaks out of the pack with his Iran dialogue and with his shutdown talk. So far, he hasn't. And Sanders has broken out of the Democratic pack, but not because of what he's done here recently.
A couple more minutes before we have to say goodbye to you. Kelsey, Pope Francis coming to the United States. He's spending the weekend here in Philadelphia. He will be addressing a joint session of Congress on September 24th. How big a deal is that in Washington?
It is a very big deal. I was at a roundtable yesterday with Nancy Pelosi, and she said that the Capitol Police described it to her as a combination of the State of the Union and an inauguration in terms of its size and scope. It is it will definitely be enthralling all of the Capitol while he is here, and he's here for several days. So I know many members are very excited about this, and even those who may not agree with some of the Pope's positions on climate change, for example, are just happy to have him come and have a chance to listen.
Well, that's interesting. And David, I want to put this to you because the Pope has really been highly critical of capitalism, the capitalist system. He's called for action on climate change. And that's really very different from what a number of members of Congress, many of them Republicans, how they stand on some of these important issues.
True, but he is both a major religious figure and a head of state, and he gets respect in these forums. I mean, whoever comes before these joint sessions, usually the partisanship stops at least for an hour or two or a day or two, and I think you're going to see that again.
And Kelsey, what is up, I guess, in the next couple of weeks?
Well, between now and when the Pope arrives, we will be focused almost exclusively on Iran and making sure that the government doesn't shut down. After that, all of our attention will be turning to probably making sure that the highways get funded at the end of October.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us in this edition of Ballot Talks on Radio Times, helping us understand what Congress is dealing with. Kelsey Snell, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And she's congressional reporter for The Washington Post. David Lightman, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. National political correspondent, also a veteran congressional reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. Kentucky County Clerk Kim Davis has been released from jail after being held for 5 days for contempt of court for refusing to issue marriage licenses to gay couples. Judge Bunning jailed her after accusing her of willful disobedience of the law. Her supporters, including her lawyer, claim she was being persecuted for religious reasons. And we asked Jeffrey Rosen to join us. He ran across the street in the rain to join us here in our Philadelphia studio. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, also a law professor at George Washington University, contributing editor for Atlantic Magazine. And he's got a new biography of Justice Louis Brandeis, will be published in June. A very busy fellow. And Jeffrey Rosen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It is great to be back.
I do want to play a clip, and then I want to talk to you about some of these really important constitutional issues at stake here. And this is Kentucky Clerk Kim Davis. She's speaking to a crowd that had gathered yesterday in anticipation of her release from jail.
Thank you all so much. I just want to give God the glory. His people have rallied, and you are a strong people. We serve a living God who knows exactly where each and every one of us is at. Just keep on pressing. Don't let down, because He is here. And He's worthy. He's worthy.
And again, Kim Davis speaking yesterday to you, Jeffrey Rosen. Did she have the right to deny marriage certificates?
Not according to Judge Bunning, as you said. In his original ruling, he said that she wasn't required to condone or endorse same-sex marriages in any way. She just had to certify that the information was accurate and the couple was qualified to marry. And then there's a provision of Kentucky law, which seems pretty clear. It says any duty enjoined by law or by the rules of civil procedure on a ministerial officer can be performed by his lawful deputy. If she can issue the licenses, so can the deputies. And they're now doing it over her signature. So in the short term, the courts held she couldn't refuse. And I think she was let out of jail because of the fact that the deputies were now issuing the licenses over her signature. But this is more broadly, as you suggested, one of the hottest and most intensely contested questions in constitutional law right now. In the wake of the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision, there is just a big question about whether people with religious objections to gay marriage, which was recognized by the court last June in its historic Obergefell decision, can refuse to perform public or private duties. And cases are bubbling up, ranging from wedding photographers and bakers who don't want to serve gay couples to not only clerks here, but also people who want exemptions from contraception mandates because of religious or moral objections. So it's an open question. There are cases bubbling up to the Supreme Court about whether people who don't want to sign the contraception mandate and allow insurance coverage to be provided by other means are having their moral objections to contraceptions violated. Most courts have said no, but one district court in D.C. just said yes. So this big question of whether my religious or moral objections to a right that the Supreme Court has recognized as fundamental can allow me an exemption is what the courts are trying to figure out right now.
Absolutely. And going back to Kim Davis, the fact that she was elected to this office, had sworn an oath, as elected officials are, to uphold the law, the Constitution, does that really put her in a different category than someone who opposes gay wedding and doesn't want to make a wedding cake, for instance, for a couple?
Yes, that's a really important distinction, and several commentators have stressed it, saying that there's a big difference between an individual who wants to assert a personal First Amendment right of free expression, not to have to make a photograph against a religious exemption, and a public official who has sworn this oath, and this is part of their official duties. We've seen this before. Before the Supreme Court recognized gay marriage, some public officials like Gavin Newsom chose to issue same-sex marriage, which was a violation of the law at the time. But after he was held to be violating the law, he accepted the consequences of that decision and actually did enforce it. What was different here is that she asserted she was basically in contempt of a court that said that she was violating the law. And that also puts her in a different category from people like Martin Luther King, who said that moral law or natural law allowed them to object to discrimination, but were willing to go to jail for their beliefs.
Well, and one of the arguments that I've read is, you know, if let's say this is a very supposed argument, say a Quaker works at a gun store and someone wants to buy, I mean, I'm just making this up, but it makes absolutely no sense. But nonetheless, someone that might have pacifist beliefs doesn't want to give someone a license for a gun, or someone who opposes intermarriage for religious reasons. Is that the sort of same category that we're talking about?
I think the distinction you just made between private and public exemptions is crucial. There are some abilities for bigoted individuals, for example, not to rent rooming houses. It's Mrs. Grundy's exception or something like that, or a private gun store owner might have certain First Amendment rights. But public officials are in a different category. Mm-hmm. Their rights depend on what the state decides. Now, North Carolina recently tried to accommodate the wishes of public officials. It said that magistrates and deed recorders don't have to issue marriage licenses if they have religious exemptions. So far, more than 30 judges have opted out in North Carolina, and there's a question whether that law violates the First Amendment's prohibition on an establishment of religion by burdening the rights of gay couples. Broadly, just to put it in its simplest form, there was a 1985 Supreme Court case that said that in religious exemption cases, you balance the interests of the states against the interest of the religious believers, and you have to take both into account. I think many courts would hold here that given the fact that marriage equality was considered a fundamental right, the state's interest in treating gay couples equally to straight couples is so significant that the religious exemptions of a official can't trump. Some courts might find it differently, but this is very open-ended stuff, and it's being decided before our eyes.
Well, and her supporters say, and I believe she has indicated as well, that she believes that she's being persecuted because of her religious beliefs. So someone said she's the first person in this country ever to go to jail for their religious beliefs or some version of that. Are they on legal or constitutional thin ice?
Well, first, it's not at all true that she'd be the first person in American history. There's an honorable tradition of people who have objected to laws on moral or religious grounds going to jail for those beliefs, including the heroic abolitionists who objected to slavery before the Civil War and were often imprisoned in the South. This is not a first. What's different is I think she's claiming that the right not to be held accountable for her beliefs, saying that she should be free not to issue the licenses and to suffer no consequences. And that's a novel claim. The judge who put her in jail for contempt was on very solid legal grounds, because contempt is what she'd expressed. And the judge who let her out on the grounds that there was a alternative, given the fact that her clerks were issuing the licenses, was trying to come up with a compromise that not everyone may agree with. Some people might say she should stay in jail until she's willing to obey the law.
And there's some question. I mean, we won't know whether she will obey the law or not.
That's right. I gather now the marriage licenses are being issued over her signature by her deputies, but she's not actually signing it.
Right.
And the question of whether that's obeying the law will have to be figured out as well.
And what she has talked about, we heard that in that clip, Give God the Glory, God's moral law. What she is saying is that I get my, I guess, legal instructions or even maybe inspiration from God's law, not the law of the land.
This claim, which is a very respectable claim in American history that God's law can trump positive law, can be traced back to the Declaration of Independence, which recognized certain unalienable rights that come from God and not government. But there is not a tradition of allowing God's law to trump positive law in our courts. It is interesting that several Republican presidential candidates have seemed to endorse this notion that a personal interpretation of natural law can trump positive law. Senator Rand Paul says it's absurd to put someone in jail for exercising their religious liberty. Ted Cruz, who we just heard from, said those who are persecuting Kim Davis believe that Christians should not serve in public office or disregard their religious faith or be sent to jail. I think more broadly, it's fair to say just descriptively that claims that my personal interpretation of God's law allow me to ignore a duly passed law of the state have not held up in American courts, and there's really not a strong tradition of recognizing that claim.
And that's Jeffrey Rosen, our guest in this edition of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia, in fact, right across the street from WHYY. And we're talking about the case of the Kentucky County Clerk Kim Davis. She was held in jail for 5 days for contempt of court, refusing to issue marriage licenses to gay couples. She has been released. It'll be interesting to see what she does when she goes back to work. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with Jeffrey Rosen about the case of Kim Davis. I'm sure you have heard about her. She's the Kentucky County Clerk who did not want to give marriage licenses to gay couples. She was held in jail for 5 days, contempt of court, released yesterday. And the judge in this case accused her of willful disobedience of the law. Her supporters have claimed that she's being persecuted for religious reasons. And as I said earlier, when there are constitutional questions of such interest and import, we always invite Jeffrey Rosen to join us again, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. We want to know how you see this case. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jeffrey, are gay couples, are they a protected class the way we think of racial, you know, people protected for race, religion, ethnicity, sex? Is sexual orientation, is that all part of how we think of protected classes of people?
It's a great question, and the Supreme Court last June said no. It did not hold that gays and lesbians were a protected class, although the Obama administration had asked them to so hold. Instead, they said that the right of marriage equality is a fundamental right that gay couples are entitled to as a matter of constitutional protection. So for that reason, that right can't be burdened in any way that makes it significantly harder for gay couples to exercise their fundamental right to marry on the same terms as straight couples. And that's the basis for the judges who have objected to Kim Davis, that she is burdening a fundamental constitutional right that gay Americans share equally with straight Americans, not that gays are a protected class.
And if we think about something like religious persecution, would it be preventing Kim Davis, for instance, from going to her church or professing her beliefs and her ideas about God and religion?
No, is the answer of the judge. She is perfectly free to express her religious beliefs in any private form. and to join protests against gay marriage and call the Supreme Court to overturn the decision. What she can't do as a public official is refuse to issue marriage licenses. It would be as if, some have noted, a gay couple or a gay person calls the police. They're being attacked, and the police officer says, "I disapprove of gays and lesbians. I'm not going to protect you." That would be a core violation of the Equal Protection Clause. And the claim here is that now that marriage equality is a fundamental right, like protection against private violence, you can't refuse to exercise it if you're a public official.
Some have said to her, well, then quit your job. I mean, if you don't like giving out marriages to gay couples, then quit your job.
You know, there's a remarkable book by Robert Cover about what judges did during the abolitionist era when they had to enforce slave laws that they thought were unfair. There were fugitive slave laws requiring people to return slaves to their masters. And the judges had three choices. They could enforce a law they thought was unjust. They could engage in civil disobedience by refusing to enforce the law. That's sort of what Kim Davis is doing. Or they could just resign. They could say, I don't think it's appropriate. I can't bring myself to enforce this unfair law. The consensus is that resignation is the more honorable point of view. That's what Martin Luther King did. He was willing to go to jail, and if he hadn't been, then he wouldn't have gone along with the law.
Mm. Let me get to. We got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. I'm not surprised, and that's great. We have Charles from Center City, Philadelphia. Charles, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. It occurred to me in this Kim Davis situation, if it was against her religious beliefs, couldn't she just resign?
In fact, that was something we were just talking about. Are you the Charles who illustrates children's books?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I recognized your voice, Charles Santori. I guess the question is quitting, but if picking up on his comment, is that an undue burden on her to because of this is something that she believes, whether you or I like it or not? Is it put an undue burden on her that she has to give up her job for her religious beliefs?
Well, that's a good question. And both the federal, it's called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and Kentucky, like many states, has a state Religious Freedom Restoration Act, say that people's religious beliefs can't be undue burden. And when there's a less restrictive alternative that the state can pursue without burdening their religious beliefs, the state should pursue it. So she's claiming that under that state law, it would be too much of a burden to resign. The judge rejected that claim because he found that that's part of her job and the law clearly requires her to do it. But that's going forward, Kentucky, like North Carolina, may choose to pass a law saying that state officials don't have to issue the licenses because it is an undue burden. And this question, it all comes down to balancing. Yes. That's why it's so hard. And people feel very strongly about this, obviously. She's saying my basic rights are being violated. It's an undue burden. The gay couples are saying our basic rights are being burdened. And the courts have to balance.
I mean, does the law trump belief? Does belief trump the law? Or is that where this kind of fuzzy-wuzzy area is? And Charles, thanks for the call.
The law trumps belief, but there are some laws that require judges to strike a balance between some beliefs and others, essentially between the interests of the religiously observant objector and the interests of the state in having its laws enforced. So it's that balance that's being struck.
An email from Warren who says, was this a deliberate test case like Rosa Parks on the bus? It seems like the lawyers were ready to go. And she does have a team of lawyers, or certainly looks like an organization of lawyers who've been very outspoken in Kim Davis's defense.
She does have a team of lawyers. There are many people around the country who care a lot about this issue and are both mobilizing in Congress to pass a federal law that would grant exemptions from anti-gay and other discrimination laws for religious believers, and also to pass more state laws like North Carolina. These lawyers are mobilizing in cases in the federal courts. Just recently in this case called March for Life Against Burwell, as I mentioned, a D.C. district judge, Judge Leon, said that two members of this organization called March for Life don't have to sign the Affordable Care Act's contraception coverage. So there are senators, congresspeople, lawyers are mobilizing around the country to test the balance between this new right of marriage equality that the Supreme Court has marriaged and rights of religious exemptions. And this is one front line in this big battle.
I thought it was interesting yesterday that Cruz and Huckabee were kind of jockeying for position for this photo op with Kim Davis. So clearly it's part of this presidential race.
That was fascinating, and it was interesting to see Jeb Bush and Lindsey Graham come out on the opposite side and basically say we do think that there should be legal exemptions passed, but for right now, the law has to be enforced.
Let me see what Kevin from Doylestown has to say. Kevin, go ahead. You're on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning, Marty.
Morning.
A very big fan of your show.
Thank you.
But I have a question and then a comment. The question is this person an elected official at this from
yes.
the state?
Or yes. Oh, she's elected.
Okay. All right. Then the comment is this. Whether she be elected or just appointed as a regular employee, if she came to me and said to me, if I were her manager, I don't wish to do this, to issue these licenses because of my religious beliefs, my response would be, I understand your religious beliefs. However, if you don't wish to fulfill your function of the job, then you can no longer work here. And I don't understand why everyone's being held up by someone who decides to interject their religious beliefs into their job, which is a public function. You don't want to do it, that's okay. You want to believe in whatever you want to believe in, but you can no longer work here.
Well,
and the question of she didn't sign the marriage licenses that were issued in her absence, and there's a question about legality, I think is also absurd. If she doesn't sign it, then some other official at that state function has a responsibility to sign and validate those licenses.
Well, Kevin, I appreciate the call, and there's a kind of a theme here, Jeffrey. As an elected official, can you be fired if you're an elected official? Or do you have to be, impeached?
I think it depends on the state constitution. If you're a federal official with life tenure, if you're a judge or a president, you can only be impeached. I think under state, that's a really interesting question. I would imagine if an individual clerk refused to perform the function, then the supervisor could fire that person, but then the clerk might file a counterclaim saying it's my religious liberty that's being violated. And then we back to precisely this question we're asking, which is what does the Constitution guarantee?
Do you see this case that are making its way up the system through the legal system?
This one, I think not so much just because all of the courts really have said that clerks have to issue the licenses. But other ones, like the ones we've been talking about, do people have to sign the contraceptive mandate? Absolutely. And the Supreme Court might end up hearing those cases soon.
We have a tweet from Dustin that says, she must resign. Orthodox Jews don't apply to McDonald's and refuse to serve bacon cheeseburgers. I mean, there are many ways you can
High holidays coming up. You should not slice and dice your McDonald's in a kosher way.
Let me see what John from, looks like Haddonfield, has to say. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Ballot Talks.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Many of Kim Davis's strongest supporters are the same people who consistently are ringing fake alarm bells about Sharia law being imposed in this country and really can't seem to stand the idea of Muslim communities practicing their faith and have these big specters of Muslim communities enforcing their religions upon United States citizens. Where's the disconnect that they don't seem to equate that when it comes to, for one rule for thee and one rule for me? It seems like there's a pretty serious blind spot because this is a very clear example of a Christian individual inflicting her faith upon the general citizenry through her capacity as an elected official.
Well, John, it's a really interesting call. Let me give Jeffrey Rosen a chance to jump in on that.
It is a fascinating point. I think they would respond, as I try to channel them, that she's not trying to impose it on an entire community. She's just an individual trying to exercise her own free exercise rights, not to have to sign it. But she's not trying to stop her clerks at the moment from doing it. So that would be the distinction they would draw. But I think the point is very good, and it really shows the tension between the First Amendment's prohibition on establishments of religion and its guarantee of the individual rights of free exercise of religion. Those two things are in tension in precisely this case.
Can a priest, a rabbi, an imam be forced to marry a gay couple?
I was going to say that sounded like a barroom.
I know. A priest, a rabbi, an imam. Exactly.
Walked into a mosque.
Right.
Can they be forced to marry a gay couple? No, the state cannot force a religion to recognize gay marriage or to recognize anything that it does not want to. The marriage equality decision stressed that religiously objecting clergy would be free to refuse to perform gay marriages, and that remains the law of the land.
And she's not clergy. She's an elected official.
She is a state.
I mean, this is sort of a secular job that she has, right?
Her job as a secular matter is not to make decisions about whether marriages are good or bad, but merely to sign the form. It's a purely ministerial act. That's why the judge said, you're not being forced to endorse these marriages at all. You're just acting in your ministerial capacity, and that's your job.
That the forms are literally just filled out correctly.
Correct.
Let me get Rick from Hokesson, Delaware. Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Great comments. My point is, I think H.L. Meacham of Baltimore would be smiling somewhere that he called Kentucky the Bible Belt, and he dubbed it, and it is, and it still is. And I find our country so interesting that we have a more secular east, the coasts are more secular, the interior of the country, more of the Bible. And that contrast is here evident, and Meacham described it in the 30s, and it's still there, and this is being fought out in the courts. But if you go to Kentucky, you'll still find areas of no alcohol is served at all in large areas of the west side of Kentucky. So I just thought it's interesting, the social dynamic of it.
Absolutely.
And I'll take my call off the air.
Yeah, Rick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jeffrey, go ahead.
It's a great point. It is true about this is a culture clash to some degree, although the states as far north as North Carolina are also engaging in this war. But I Kentucky is a fascinating state, and I'm going to put in a plug. My hero, Justice Louis Brandeis, you mentioned my biography.
He's
from Louisville, Kentucky, and he, back in the Civil War era, he was born 5 years old at the Battle of Bull Run. His mother's an abolitionist, but most of the state is pro-slavery but pro-union. And, of course, he's a very secular Jew who ends up founding the American Zionist movement. But Kentucky has always been at the crossroads of the culture war. It was in the Civil War. It was now. And Brandeis believed that the University of Louisville at Kentucky was one of the greatest institutions and devoted his life to really shoring it up. So I'm a big Kentucky fan.
Having just written a great big book, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Oh, we have an email from Mike. He says, is it reasonable to ask if Kim Davis is acting directly against the First Amendment? I got something discovering. Let me do this again. An email from Mike. Is it reasonable to ask if Kim Davis is acting directly against the First Amendment by, as an agent of government, she is establishing religious standards?
It is reasonable to claim that, and some claim that that is the case. Others counter that she's not, that under state statutes, she has her personal religious beliefs that are protected and can't be unduly burdened. So the question is excellent, and it shows this basic clash between, is this an establishment of religion or is it the free exercise of religion? And these are really hard questions to answer.
How's this going to end? I mean, as you look into your constitutional crystal ball.
That's not worth much. There seems to be some kind of accommodation in Kentucky, so the marriage licenses are being issued. I think the next step will be pressure to introduce a law in Kentucky, as there is in North Carolina, allowing Kim Davis and other people to continue to refuse to do that. I don't know the politics on the ground. The governor did order her to issue the licenses. Not sure whether that law will pass, but many of these laws will be proposed. So far, Kentucky and Utah have adopted them. So over the next year, we're going to see lots of states considering whether to allow clerks not to issue marriage licenses.
Even though the Supreme Court has ruled on this.
But you asked what the next phase is.
Yeah.
Then the question is whether that North Carolina and Utah law itself violates the Establishment Clause, which the gentleman just answered. And you could say that, yes, that by bending over backward to allow state individuals not to enforce a fundamental right, the state is establishing religion. So that's – the Supreme Court may well give us the answer to the question of the last caller before too long.
So this issue continues.
Yes, it will, like all great constitutional
issues. Right. Keep you in business,
yes,
for sure.
It does.
Jeffrey Rosen, thank you so much.
Thank you. Always great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And again, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. And as he has mentioned, he has a new biography of Justice Louis Brandeis, and it will be published in June. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, and we appreciate all those phone calls to Radio Times and comments as well. You can download a podcast of the program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We will be right back.